Hour number two here on 102.5 The Game. Darren McFarland, Steve Lehman alongside News Channel 5. Willie Donick will join us a little bit later this hour. We're live here at Bridgestone Arena inside Jack Daniels Barrel House. Tonight it's the Predators and the Sharks. 7 o'clock puck drop pregame starting at 6. Everything heard right here on 102.5 The Game. So the game against San Jose. San Jose has been playing really good hockey. We'll get a report about them in the final hour of the program. Kind of watching some chatter up north in Canada. They're probably upset over the women losing the gold to the U.S., curling their sport. They didn't get a gold
in. It's been a rough 12 hours.
So now
Canada.
They have turned their attention to the trade deadline and some of the chatter up there as we are making it. We should have Richard Deitch here in just a second. The chatter is toward Ottawa's Erik Karlsson. So a lot of stuff involving Erik Karlsson. We'll come back to that.
Somebody find the eyeball emojis for that.
Yeah.
I mean.
And the Predators were also mentioned in a lot of that chatter.
Well, I mean, that's specifically what I'm talking about. Pierre LeBrun says David Poile at least reached out about the possibility of acquiring Erik Karlsson. Talk about an embarrassment of riches.
Yeah.
If you could somehow get Erik Karlsson on that defensive line, I don't even know why you would go after that, frankly, unless they're truly giving away. They're holding a garage sale. They're selling all their old lampshades.
Everything must go. 80% off.
Right.
Everything must go.
You can get an Erik Karlsson for $1.
Yeah. Or it's a smokescreen for other people to overpay for Erik Karlsson if he's really available. Keep
possibly
that in mind.
So.
Yeah, there may be GMs that freak out and go, what, the Predators are going to trade for Erik Karlsson? We got to step it up. All right, let's get Richard Deitch in here from Sports Illustrated, the author of The Media Circus. Richard, how you doing?
How are you guys? Erik Karlsson, by the way, I think is a free agent, right? So that's actually an interesting proposition for any team that wants to acquire him. Unless you're willing to pay that big money, it essentially is a postseason rental, but it could be a postseason rental that wins you the cup.
Yeah, it's interesting, Richard. They were in here on Monday night, and we got a first look at Erik Karlsson. He's a tremendous player. He's one of the top defensemen in the league, but he had an awful turnover. I mean, awful turnover that led directly to a Predators goal and an eventual Predators victory. So, you know, we get caught up. I try to say a lot of times because fans get caught up with when turnovers happen. And I got that. And I was like, if you broke down every player in the league in film when we had film study, you would see all the greats make mistakes. They're human beings.
Right.
And Erik Karlsson made a bad one here Monday night.
I was going to say, just breaking, Michael Jordan's missed some shots in his career.
That's right. No doubt. What was your reaction? We talked about it at the beginning of the show. And I kept saying all week, I was like, I have a feeling. I was, you know, it's just I just thought the women were going to respond, and it was so cool to see it actually play out and see them get the gold.
It's great. Yeah, I stayed up. I went to bed at 2:30 a.m. in New York. Well worth the tired eyes today. I've seen, let me count, about three of those games live, gold medal games, in Vancouver, in Sochi. I want to say maybe Turin, check my math on that. And the games, being at the arena, the intensity and the level of sort of energy and tension is just unbelievable. So I can only imagine what it was like to be there last night. And I thought the Americans were the better team, but I have to admit, just having seen this time and time again, I thought Canada was going to score late in the third and win. I'd seen that before. They're a very, very good third period team. They seem to have had the Americans' numbers in the Olympics. Then when you watch the overtimes, clearly the Americans were better. They had fresher legs. 4-on-4 is a better game for them. And so my thought was after the overtime period, I thought they would win. As great as that Canadian goaltender played, I thought they were the better team from overtime on.
What's the atmosphere like at those games since you've covered it? What is the atmosphere? Because right now it's hard to tell. On television, in some cases, Richard, I've been disappointed. I look at some of these events and, you know, the venues, and I'm thinking, where is everybody?
Yeah, you got to keep in mind, the games in South Korea, the South Koreans aren't in the gold medal game. If there aren't a lot of Americans and Canadians traveling, you're not going to get the same kind of arena energy as you would for, you know, a Vancouver Olympics or an Olympics where a lot of Americans or Canadians have traveled. In South Korea, clearly, you didn't see a lot of North Americans travel for these Olympics. That said, you know, if you were sitting where I was in the press section, which is very close a lot of times to the U.S. athletes or the Canadian athletes who show up to cheer on their fellow teammates, it's really intense. And you just, even if the atmosphere isn't like, you know, 50,000 people screaming, the tension on the ice is so great because you really do feel like every possession matters. If you have any sense of women's hockey, you understand that these players essentially are training for one game. Unless something catastrophic happens, the U.S. and Canada are going to get to the finals. There's essentially only one other team I would even give like a puncher's chance of beating either team, and that's Finland. But Finland can't really score. They have the best goalie in the world, I would argue, but they can't really score with the Americans and Canadians. So just imagine, like, you basically train 4 years for one game, and you always feel, at least I did, I always felt the tension when I was there. And then, you know, and again, this is not something that viewers are going to see, but covering it, you get to see the players after the on-ice ceremony, after the game, and the U.S. players, every time I've interviewed, I mean, I'm not sure I've seen more devastated athletes over the last couple of Olympics, and that's really where it sort of just speaks to how much energy and how much time and preparation they've put into this singular game, and they've, generally speaking, lost it in heartbreaking fashion. If you remember 4 years ago, what I think maybe a minute and 30 left or a minute 45 left, there was a U.S. defenseman, Kelly Stack. Canadians had pulled their goalie. She cleared it. She was a defenseman, cleared it from U.S. lane to the ice. It hit the post. Literally 1 inch to the right, tucks in, game over. You know, those U.S. women are famous forever. And probably their lives change in terms of endorsements, in terms of opportunities. So that's just how close the series has been. And, you know, if you believe in karma a little bit, it seemed like the Americans were due, and they got one last night. Incredible move to win it in the shootout. That's going to be a replay, I think, that we see for a long time.
Yeah, I heard the crowd described last night as one-third American, one-third Canadian, and one-third South Koreans trying to figure out why everybody in the arena was about to have a heart attack.
Right, yeah. That's good. By the way, you know, conversely, this is why the Olympics are great. If you are in Pyeongchang and you go to a short track speed skating, that the place will be nuts. I mean, if you think like Predators in the conference finals is loud, like that's going to be insane. So that's sort of the beauty of the Olympics, is each of the countries have their sport that they really, really care about. You know, when I was in Sochi, I was pretty fortunate. I saw Russia play Canada, in talking about the men's, in the round robin. So, you know, the men's hockey tournament in Sochi was really, really important to the Russians. Ovechkin's face was basically everywhere on every poster at the airport I landed. I mean, it was essentially the face of the games for them. And so, you know, you want to talk about tension and just, like, you know, a bit of menace in the air. Like, that was just fascinating to be. And I was sitting in the crowd. I wasn't covering that. I happened to get a seat from one of my bosses. And so that's always what's interesting to me about the Olympics is, like, depending on what country you're in, they all have a sport that they favor, or they all have a sport that their fans are really obsessed by. And if you could somehow get tickets to that's like an experience you'll never forget.
Richard, another longtime guy. I feel like we've talked a lot to you over the last couple of years about longtime broadcasters leaving the booth, and it came to a close, at least on ESPN, for Mike Patrick last night. He was a part of the broadcast at Duke, Louisville, and Duke basketball game. He did his last football game was on December 30th, which happened to be a bowl game the Memphis Tigers were involved in. But a 35-year run has come to an end. Do you think he's truly done, and what do you think about Mike Patrick as a whole?
I honestly don't know if he's done. Usually, unless it's health reasons, these guys want to keep going on. So we'll see with that. I'm trying to be very honest with your audience all the time. Mike Patrick had a great longevity in his career. He had some incredible assignments. He was not nearly close to one of the broadcasters I particularly like, whether he was working on Monday Night Football or even his Vital days. I honestly always found him to be an absolute cheerleader for the establishment. Never really a guy who called anything out. Great voice, obviously, very good down and distance, but it's not one of my, the guys who I think about sort of like who I always will have reverence for, the Vern Lundquist, Keith Jackson and Scully and Mike Emmerich. Mike Patrick's not in that department to me. That said, you have a 35-year career where you did Monday Night Football, You did ESPN's number one college basketball games. You did college football at the highest level. That's a great career. So
women's Final Fours.
You know, all props to him on that. But honestly, not one of my guys. I always sort of found him to be a little bit too much of part of the establishment. But that, you know, that's probably my punk rock roots coming through. So it's probably more on me than Mike Patrick.
Visiting with Richard Deitch here on Darren and Donick. Richard, sticking in the broadcasting realm, ESPN announced that Kirk Herbstreit is going to sort of step in and take over the John Gruden role in part of their NFL draft coverage coming up in late April. What do you think about that move, first of all, and maybe more importantly to a lot of football fans out there, where does the Gruden role moving forward stand now? Who's the most likely guy to step into that mix on Monday Night Football?
Well, I'm just going to make the assumption that Kirk Herbstreit is going to demand that Johnny Manziel is drafted number one if he's going to follow in the Gruden footsteps. That should be fun for the draft coverage. This is a massive upgrade to me. Quite frankly, anybody on this call, in my opinion, would be a massive upgrade from John Gruden in the draft. While he absolutely knew the quarterbacks that he worked with in QB camp, Gruden falls in love too much with players. And I think you saw that on the draft coverage, you know, especially the quarterbacks. Too many quarterbacks for John Gruden when they were coming up were, you know, the next fill-in-the-blank Hall of Famer. And so I think Herbstreit, because he sees the college game, I think he'll be an interesting voice there. He's also a guy who shares the mic really well. So I think he'll let guys like Lewis Riddick and Mel Kiper, McShay, these are really the stars of that draft, shine. So I think he'll be an interesting voice, and I think that was I had not heard that before it was announced. I think that's an interesting move by ESPN. It's not always a place that does interesting moves. I actually find that interesting. In terms of Monday Night Football, you know, you guys might have seen the Post report, New York Post report not too long ago about Peyton Manning. I have no doubt that ESPN has reached out to Manning's officials by now. One of their executives told me a month ago that they were planning to do that. I'm sure they've done that. I'm sure it's basically a blank check for Peyton. I can't see him taking a broadcasting job, and if he does take a broadcasting job, I think he would take the Fox job on Thursday night, far before the ESPN Monday Night Football. So I'll continue to say for Monday Night Football, I think they'll stay in-house. I think their best sort of cost-efficient play. So you're looking at a Matt Hasselbeck, a Randy Moss, sort of people in that kind of season. I don't expect it to be Rex Ryan. But that would be my guess. There's not anybody out there, you know, other than Peyton, who's like, you know, let's bring this guy in. It's a difference maker. It's not Bruce Arians, who might have a future in broadcasting, but I think he needs some reps. Joe Thomas, Browns offensive lineman, seems to be a really good prospect, and I think he could be really, really good one day. But that's, to me, asking a lot to put a guy who has no broadcasting experience nationally into a number one job. I mean, it worked with CBS for Romo, but, you know, they invested 9 months in that. And Romo's a quarterback, and it is different. He sees the whole field, where Joe Thomas only sees the field from his line position. So if I had to guess, I'm going to still stick with a combination of a Matt Hasselbeck and either a third person or Matt Hasselbeck solo.
Richard, I'll shill for your company here for a moment. The most interesting and perhaps alarming sports story I read this week was a real-life Animal House, John Wertheim, Jessica Luther with SI Now, on the state of disarray, frankly, and disorder in the Mavericks organization. What do you make of that story? And more importantly, should the fallout be for Mark Cuban and the Mavs moving forward off of this?
Good question. Two great reporters, by the way, and John Wertheim and Jessica Luther, and you know, they clearly had the goods. You saw Cuban's response. There was no denials. There was no, this is out of context, etc. He, you know, as the owner, he pretty much owned it. The question, of course, is going to be, what did he know, and when did he know it, and what should the NBA do about it? I think the NBA has to hold its own independent investigation away from the Mavericks, and I think they have to come up with some kind of findings as to how bad that culture was. If you read the story, it's bad. You know, you wonder how much else maybe the reporters didn't find. What I don't know, and this is where you'd have to have somebody who's more of an NBA expert or a legal expert than me, is what's the precedent for punishment? Obviously, we saw the precedent with Donald Sterling, but that was, you know, a 20, 30-year history, and the NBA Board of Governors essentially forced him to leave his franchise. That's not going to happen with Cuban, I don't think. But, you know, is there a monetary fine that sort of can be equaled here? Do you take draft picks away from the Mavs? That, I don't know the answer to that, but that's a very interesting question to me, is if the NBA finds that there was some systematic sexual harassment and a horrible workplace culture for the Mavericks, what is a fair punishment for them?
And it seems like all the reports, everything you read, and you're right. Thanks for bringing that up, Steve. Great work by you guys, Richard. This was a culture that was there to, set up to protect him. I mean, it was doing just the opposite. You're supposed to be protecting alleged victims, and it looked like everything was a cover-up to protect his behavior over the years in Dallas, which
was pathetic. I don't want a Monday morning quarterback this, and it's certainly, I've done no reporting on this. I don't get any credit here, but it's a little hard to swallow. And this is not necessarily just blaming Cuban directly, but it's hard to swallow that a guy like that, the GM of the franchise, could have been running, roughshod on people for that long, and nothing had been done about it. It makes you think that this is happening in other organizations, probably in sports. And, you know, when you have, and this happens at all companies, but I'm glad that Wertheimer & Luther really exposed this. When the human the HR department is not working for you, but they're working for the bosses, that's a really bad and scary company to be at.
Yes.
That's supposed to be the place in the company where you could confidentially let them know things that are happening with you as an employee, particularly if there are things going on that are criminal or harassment or whatever. And it was very clear that the Mavericks had a setup led by that GM where he had an HR person who wasn't doing any kind of due diligence for the employees. He was essentially covering up and enabling this general manager's behavior. Then you take the Mavericks, like, .com writer. I mean, that's just not doing your job in terms of background checks and stuff.
That's
how
insane.
It is. That's one where, I mean, it's hard to take Cuban's explanation. It's in the end, the buck stops with him. How do you not do some kind of rudimentary background check on employees like that? And then when you find something, how do you bring them back? If there's any positive to this story, and maybe there isn't, but if there's any positive, I have immense respect for how the Mavericks players have come out and not tried to, like, circle the wagons and say, you know, everybody's against us, which we see so often in college football and college basketball towns when we read these kind of stories. You know, people like Nowitzki are like, this disgusts me. This has to be cleaned up. That's good. That's really taking ownership where, you know, you see stories of this happening in colleges across the country. And what is the first thing the fan base and other people in the athletic department do? It's less about let's clean it up and more about the media is wrong. The media is out to get us. This is a witch hunt. So I give the Mavericks players a lot of credit. I feel like they've at least said the right things.
Well, they've had a lot of time to think about it since they're tanking, right?
It's true. Which, yeah, they're not going anywhere. But I'll tell you, and again, this might be just something for you guys to get a guest on. I'd be really interested to hear from a legal expert who has, like, NBA knowledge and background. Like, what could legitimately be the penalty for the Mavericks? That's very interesting to me. And that's where we're eventually going to be heading down the road.
Richard, really good stuff as always. Have a great rest of your week and a good weekend. We'll do it again next week.
You got it. See you guys.
Go check out his stuff on Sports Illustrated. He's the author of The Media Circus, Richard Deitch. We'll come back with a lot more next on 102.5 The Game.